Okay. I'd like to introduce our speaker this morning, Dr. Sajil Chaudhry. Dr. Chaudhry did his undergraduate work at Punjab University in Lahore, Pakistan, and did medical school at the King Edward's Medical College in Lahore. He did his internship at Frankfurt Hospital, part of Thomas Jefferson Health System in Philadelphia, and did several residency rotations, part of the University of Miami system, and McGill, as well as Baskin Palmer. He's trained in neuro-ophthalmology, pediatric neurology, and ultimately did a residency at the Cleveland Clinic here in Weston in neurology, and did a neuro-oncology fellowship at the University of Calgary at the Tom Baker Cancer Center. His specialties are neuro-oncology and neurology and primary and secondary brain and spinal tumors. This morning, Dr. Chaudhry is going to speak on novel therapeutic strategies in high-grade glioma management. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Chaudhry.
Okay, thank you very much for being here this morning, and hopefully this will be the first of several talks over the years. And I often tell my patients that we can do all the amazing new things within like the oncology arena, but what is perhaps most important is that we're just here to take our patients through a journey. And point A to point B, it might be a tumor that has a good outcome. We have a good surgeon here who can perform a good operation, and then following treatments afterwards, and all that is good. But I feel that experience through that journey from point A to point B is most important. And so all of us as, essentially caring for these patients, it is very critical that we make that experience better. And it's the outcomes are critical. Of course, the outcomes are going to be important. But that journey between point A and point B perhaps is most important. My goal today was to go through several slides and hopefully stay on time, and in 1 hour give you a recap of what I learned in over the past 15, 20 years, if you will. I've always taken a lot of inspiration from this man here, and most of you know Dr. Cushing's work, but many of you may not know that he was also famous for his quotes, and there are books written on essentially Harvey Cushing quotes. Harvey is important within kind of like the neuro-oncology arena because the initial classification of brain tumors was first coined by Harvey Cushing many, many years ago. And it's kind of fascinating that many of his initial brain tumor classification items still stand strong, even though we reclassify brain tumors every 5 to 7 years. There were a few quotes that I've taken, I've heard over the years, and I feel that this sums up our practice in general, not just neuro-oncology, but essentially any practice that you may practice, and that is very critical for us to treat a patient as a whole, not just their disease, a good operation, experimental trials, options in regards to doing their treatment, but to treat a patient as a whole. It's a patient who's a husband, who's a wife, has a family, and they only spend a small time or a fraction of their time within our clinics, and then they go out to the world, and they spend 2 weeks there and 4 weeks there. I feel as a physician, all of us, that we need to also focus on that what are they feeling or what's happening within their lives as they leave our clinic, and in between the next appointment, what happened. And it is also important, in spite of our time, and we're very busy, several patients a day, calls from the ER and whatnot, that it's important to focus on their lives. Now, I felt that when I was asked to speak, I felt that talking about this particular tumor type is critically important, because if you look at neuro-oncology within like the adult arena, essentially gliomas would be about 50 to 60% of our practice. And gliomas are essentially substratified, and I'll go down a few slides later into high-grade gliomas and essentially benign gliomas. Now, when you look at neuro-oncology in general, if you're a student coming through my clinics, one of the first statements that I will say is you have to stratify brain tumors into primary brain tumors and also secondary brain tumors, which are essentially going to be like the metastatic tumors. Now, when you look at the overall, you know, if you look at the footprint, the number of metastatic brain tumors will be far greater than the number of essentially primary brain tumors. And maybe at a different day, a different topic, or a different time, I can speak about some of the other kinds of brain tumors that go to the brain from other essential sites. So primary brain and spine tumors, about 15-20% of those tumors. High-grade gliomas will essentially be approximately 50-55%. Now, in children, that you will classify them just a little bit differently. Gliomas are not as common, but in the adult population, which is who we feel in our we take care of in our hospital, about 50-55%. Now, glioblastoma, GBM, is that tumor pathology that I spend a lot of my time treating, and it's important because majority of those glial tumors in adult, actually about 60-70%, unfortunately, are going to be GBMs. Glioblastomas, even in the days of Harvey Cushing, if you read some of his initial, some of his work initially, that he reported a median survival of 9 to 10 months, and this is going back almost, and even over the years, that we haven't expanded that survival, and our median survival now is about 18 to 24 months. I feel that if we are essentially aggressive, we treat these tumors aggressively, that our median survivals could increase. There is a case here that I wanted to highlight, and I feel that we can learn a lot of lessons by one case. We also fortunately have our share of essentially long-term survivors, but the median survival for GBMs is 2 years, if not less. Now, a lot of the research, if you look at the NIH funding research, most of the monies that we get, which, as you know, is now few and far between, but it is advised that, or we are asked to do most of our research in essentially glioblastomas, but that's going to be kind of like the burden of disease. Now, if you look at the essential pie chart of gliomas, as I mentioned, you can see that GBMs are going to take kind of like a big share than other glial tumors. Anaplastic gliomas are about 8%, and some of the more low-grade gliomas are 15.7%, 9.2%. So again, just to give you a little snapshot why gliomas are critically important and high-grade gliomas especially. We always start in the world of, you know, in our world, oncology in general, not just this subtype of oncology. We always try to subclassify tumors. And why is that important? If we can subclassify tumors, we know their tumor type. Every tumor's treatment is going to be different, radiation, chemotherapy, et cetera. So classification is important. Some of the initial classifications of brain tumors date back to the 1830s, 1860s, when according to looking at, you know, essentially pathology slides and whatever means they had back then, reviewing pathology slides, attempts were made to stratify tumors. And then essentially Harvey Cushing and a close colleague, Bailey and Cushing, classified them back in 1926. Now, Bailey and Cushing's classification lasted for many years, and then we have some of the recent classification, which is where we are now. Now, the most accepted, well-accepted classification for glioma tumors are going to be the WHO classification. When you look at gliomas, some are more common, of course, but just to keep it in mind, they're essentially the astrocytic tumors, oligodendrogliomas. Even the ependymomas are actually glial tumors. We treat them very differently, but they're also essentially gliomas. And then there are most uncommon gliomas like PXAs, subependymal giant cell astrocytomas, and probably I might see 2 to 5 of these cases per year. But when you look at the astrocytic tumors, we'll see several a month. Glioblastomas, as we classify these tumors, higher grade, as you may know, are more aggressive. Lower grades are essentially the benign tumors. Now, the polycytic astrocytomas, which mostly occur in kids, we'll see them within adults as well. I probably see 2 to 5 adult cases of polycytic tumors, and most of those tumors are those that occurred when they were children, but then they just never grew to a certain amount and finally caused, you know, symptoms when patients got into their 20s and 30s. So we're going to just hone down, guys. I'm trying to bring you to where we essentially need to be. We're going to just hone down on these four tumor types. Well, so whenever you think about high-grade gliomas, as I mentioned before, GBMs are going to be that kind of like the vast majority of them. But there are three other important high-grade glioma subtypes that are treated similarly but also essentially differently. And now within the experimental trials arena, there's one clinical trial that I'm going to highlight later that we're now essentially able to recognize that not all high-grade gliomas are the same. We feel that it is the tumors are transforming as time goes on. Like often in our world, we'll see a young patient who's diagnosed with like a grade 2 astrocytic tumor, and then we manage the patient whichever way we manage surgery or other treatments. And then over years, those tumors will actually degenerate and become grade 3 tumors, and then they're always trying to become grade 4 tumors. And that's why when I was training for a lot of the low-grade tumors, more teaching philosophy or the way I was taught was if it's a low-grade, a young patient, leave those patients alone, do a good operation, remove the tumor, do a biopsy, and watch them. Now, there are some young patients we still do that, like a patient with a tumor that could have been removed. You know, we're able to achieve a removal. There's almost nothing left. Those patients we will still follow. But then there's a large variety of cases that are essentially low-grade tumors that there's almost been like a paradigm shift. And 15, 20 years ago, we would watch them. But now we feel that by watching them, we are allowing the tumor to actually degenerate to more high-grade tumors. So there is a subset now that we treat these low-grade tumors more aggressively. So we'll have a young patient in their 20s or 30s, but we're not going to just do a good operation, but actually chemotherapy, radiation options, and essentially experimental trials are now becoming more common. So there is, that's one of the take-home points, that even the low-grade gliomas that we use to render them as essentially being, you know, low-grade tumors, benign tumors, patients can live normal lives, and some of them can, but that's kind of like a small proportion of them, that we treat them more aggressively on a case-by-case basis. We try to prevent them from actually degenerating to more of the aggressive tumors down the road. So that is a very important point there. So high-grade gliomas are these four tumor types. Now, when we essentially manage high-grade gliomas, I like to think about them in essentially three ways. There's the tumor that we see on the MRI, right? That's essentially kind of the macroscopic disease. You do an MRI, a patient comes in with a seizure, comes to the ER, you get a call from the ER, did an MRI, it's not a stroke, it looks like a tumor. We have a good neurosurgeon, which we do here. We can hopefully achieve a gross total resection. But even after a gross total resection, especially when you look at GBMs, most of you know that 50-60% will recur within the first year. So even after a gross total resection, everything on the MRI, or we made the MRI look better, everything that was there has been removed, within a year without treatment, actually without treatment, within 4 to 6 months, those tumors will essentially come back. So that's where the whole field takes birth, that there's always, you know, there's always an element of actually microscopic disease, and we have to focus on that part as well. I often get the question in the hospital consultation that, well, Dr. Chowdhury, we removed the whole tumor. Why do we have to do chemotherapy, radiation, clinical trials? That's because we're addressing the issue that there's always going to be microscopic disease. And time is of the essence. The earlier we treat these tumors and the more aggressively we treat them, that's going to be critically important. Now the great new frontier, as we call it, which is not that new anymore, 5 years ago it was, that there's also a component that we can treat the macroscopic disease, we can make the MRI look very good, we can do radiation, chemotherapy, clinical trials, but every patient's tumor needs to be individualized. Not everybody with a high-grade glioma, with anaplastic glioma, or having a GBM should be treated the same. And in our past lives, I confess, up till this point, we've been treating all kinds of cancers the same. And for the past 5 years, there's been another shift in which now we are actually trying to essentially treat patients individually according to their specific tumor type. So now we know that if you substratify glioblastomas, And a lot of these fancy genomic markers we're not doing locally in our lab. Hopefully our program builds up. We get enough busy that it'll be cost effective to do many of these tests in our lab. But there are a few labs they're very expensive, but most insurance companies will pick up the tab. Some don't. It's been an ongoing battle. But almost everybody with a high-grade glioma that passes through my clinic will actually be tested. And we will get like a report of their genomic markers. And lo and behold, many of those genomic markers, it's nice to get, 50 gene abnormalities. And all of you would agree that it's nice to get that. But when you go in to see a patient, they'll be excited to hear that you've done all these fancy testings. But at the end of the day, what they really want to know, and that's about the journey, that is just going to make a difference. Is it going to make a difference in their survival, in their outcome? Can we cure this tumor or not? They already know when they come into our clinics that, well, it's a high-grade glioma. My median survival is 2 years or less. And they'll search you on Google. They know what you've done in your past life. And they know all the treatments. They actually come and tell you about some clinical trials that are being done in some places they want you to send you there. But so what's really important is what can we take action on? And that's kind of a key phrase these days within like the oncology arena, that we test all these fancy genomics, but is there any genomic marker that we can take action on? And action meaning, is there a targeted drug? That's kind of like the amazing part of this. Is there like a targeted drug that would be individualized for that patient, would shut down the tumor above and beyond standard therapies? So that's where the whole field of oncology, not just neuro-oncology, is shifting now. Is trying to individualize therapy. Now this change has been going on for about 5 years now. Well, I would say about 10 years, but it certainly gained a lot of traction over the past 5 years. So everybody coming into our clinic will eventually be tested, and genomic markers will be tested. Now, 5 years ago, I used to get excited about just sending it off to a fancy lab and then getting all these markers back. But from like an academic value, for you and I, it's important to know that sitting in our office. But remember, when we go and see the patient, we have to come up, or there has to be actionable items there that we can actually do something about it. I always feel that within our field, within like the neuroscience arena, I always like to quote that a famous person once said that you learn this field, essentially case at a time. So if you treat one case from beginning, hopefully to a very long end or no end, you will learn a lot of lessons, and it's important for us to remember. This is a case that I treated a few years ago, and was a young man, completely intact. It was a classic ER admission that all of you will see. And 53, essentially went to the gym every day, very healthy, did all the right things. Unfortunately, all of our patients are like that, or most of them are like that. They come in and say, well, I've done everything right. Never smoked, never drank. I'm in the gym 7 days a week. Why would this happen? So those are kind of like the unknowns that why these tumors occur. Now, came in, had a seizure, presented to the ER, and subsequent MRI showed a large left frontal tumor. Now, as you can see, most right-handed people are gonna be left hemispheric dominant. So the first concern that I and the team at that point had, that it is essentially a left frontal tumor. It's like the dominant hemisphere. The man is only 53. He's healthy, completely intact. So two things will come from here. If this case went to some of the smaller hospitals, or some of the surgeons who may not be as aggressive. I need to be careful what I say. Many will just do a biopsy, right? And back many years ago, that was probably enough. Just do a biopsy, get essentially, know what the tumor is, and then we can treat accordingly. Now, in some of the bigger centers, we will also do biopsies, but then it's usually a second stage operation that will go in and will remove the tumor and maybe do some fancy imaging and be able to remove the tumor and do like a maximal safe resection, as we call them, and cause less harm to the patient. But in a lot of the smaller hospitals, smaller than our hospital, they're just doing a biopsy, and I think that would not be a good thing for this patient especially and also others. So I will often get cases referred that just had small operations or biopsies, and then we'll put a team together, review those cases, and then hopefully remove and be able to go in and try to take out the tumor. So that's what we did here. He didn't have a biopsy, but came straight to us, and went through an operation. Luckily, we were safe. It was a good operation, and surgery was about 5 years ago. Now, I mentioned this case because this patient is still alive. And when I moved from where I was before, I moved down to Boca Raton, this patient now comes down and sees me, follows up, is still doing treatment. But this is, and I'll disclose what the tumor came back as. But this is a good outcome so far, a good story. So surgery was about 5 years ago, and I want to just put into your mind about essentially this technology. Now essentially glial cell wafers are essentially chemotherapy dipped wafers that a surgeon will implant during the operation. Now, we 20, 30 years ago realized that we're not curing these tumors. They're very aggressive even after maximal resections. Their recurrence rates are very high. Even after clinical trials and all the treatments we were doing, we weren't curing them. And one of the challenges we faced that we were not sure how much chemotherapy is actually getting across to the brain. So that was and that's always been a challenge. So this is probably the only device or the only way of delivering chemotherapy directly. There's been other attempts. There's been injection of chemotherapy directly within the cavity. Most of those clinical trials were not actually positive. Actually, some of them caused a lot of harm to patients. So the only approved local therapy as of today that's FDA approved for high-grade gliomas is essentially glial cell wafers. And so the wafers are essentially put into the cavity. They self-absorb within 1 month, maximum about 3 to 4 months, and it delivers chemotherapy directly to the tumor. Now, there is data, and today I may not have time to discuss that data, but there is data that the median survival can improve by up to 3 months. So it's not a large improvement, but it was actually significant enough for the FDA to approve it. Now, we haven't done much of any wafer work here so far, but I'm hoping on a case-by-case basis we'll be able to do it. Now, the big challenge with using essentially glial cell wafers over the years has been that a lot of clinical trials will preclude patients from going on trials if essentially those if that's placed. Now, there's a lot of debate within the oncology community that why would those patients not be included in trials because it's an FDA-approved treatment. So now there are trials being designed, and I'm hoping we'll be able to open some of them here that actually will include patients who have had essentially placed. Now, and it makes sense because clinical trials should be above and beyond, that all the standard treatments are applied, and then if the tumor grows or we want to do something more than that, then we can essentially do trials. So this patient had a good operation, good resection. I would think it's almost a gross total resection. This could be, and this is a day or two post-operative, so some of that enhancement could be post-op changes, could be some tumor remain, But it was overall a good outcome, a good operation. Now, pathology, as you may have you may have thought, came back to be grade 4 GBM, glioblastoma. When you look at the pathology slides, one of the items when we discuss these cases, we essentially have like a case conference in which we discuss all these tumors every Thursday morning from 8 to 9. All of you are welcome to attend. And this is the kind of stuff we do. We look at the MRIs. Many of them are essentially post-op cases, but in good neuro-oncology centers, it's asked of team members, or it's seen good if those cases can be presented preoperatively. But as you know, a case comes into the ER, is having recurrent seizures. The surgeon on call says that I have time tonight. Let's just take the case in for surgery. That's okay, no problem. But we can discuss cases prospectively, and then talk about experimental trials. And we're in the process of building a good program here. It encompasses not only standard therapies but experimental trials that our patients in the community do not have to go to big academic centers, but will get the same care here. So when pathologists look at GBM slides, they look for necrosis. So these are actually areas of necrosis, and the cells are lining around the necrosis. You can also see actually vascular growth. So any aggressive malignancy, be it breast cancer, lung cancer, or any tumor type, you will almost see the same. You will see necrosis, and you will see essentially blood vascular growth. These cancers need blood vessels to grow, and blood vascular growth has also been a potential target for us to try to shut these tumors down. And hopefully, time permitting, I'll try to go into some of those details. So it was a pretty slam dunk diagnosis, grade 4 glioblastoma. Second slide, just a little bit of a more of like a high power view. You can see the blood vascular growth, a lot of cells. So one of the first impact you guys have is that it seems very active, a very, you know, essentially a tumor that is growing very fast. So that's not a good sign. Pseudopalocytic necrosis is that key phrase that the cells, highly active cells are palisading around the areas of necrosis and also essentially microvascular proliferation, which is this vascular growth. Now, what are the options? We have this case. This case can come in today. The same case, good operation, comes to you. What are the options? Now, I just wanted to talk just for a few seconds about that there are two sides to the story. Some believe that these are high-grade tumors. Are we really impacting their overall survival? And that's been a conversation in our community, at least, for the past 10 to 15 years. And some argue that we should not be aggressive. Just do a biopsy or a maximal or a small resection, get enough tissue, and then do other treatments, clinical trials, you know, other options, chemotherapy, radiation. But most of the major academics would agree that if we can achieve a gross total resection, there is a survival benefit. But not only by removing tumor, even if it's a 60% resection, not a 95% resection, we are still actually helping the patient because we're reducing bulk load. There are often these tumors, when they come into the hospital, they have a lot of edema around them, and patients are actually symptomatic more from the edema than from the tumor itself. So by taking away the pressure effect, by taking away the kind of like the area of the tumor that is pressing against the brain, there's also value in doing that. So the value of surgery is not only getting a, you know, tissue diagnosis, but it's also reducing bulk. And I've seen it over my years that the element of actually necrosis from treatments thereafter, from chemotherapy necrosis and other ways, there's a less chance of necrosis, which often becomes an issue because the brain is kind of like a closed environment, and there's not a lot of space to grow there. So when there's necrosis, there's a lot of pressure effect. So there is a lot of value in trying to debulk these tumors. Now, I do agree that there are going to be times in which there's a tumor that just can't be removed, and it's potentially more harmful to the patient to remove the tumor, and it might be best to just do a biopsy. And then those cases we have, and then we always try to do the best we can. A few pictures to highlight that the intraoperative placement of like the gliadin wafers. So there's shapes, size of like a dime size wafers, and they're basically coated around the surgical cavity. Again, we have not done too much of this thus far, but I'm hoping in the future on a case-by-case basis we'll be able to do that. I don't even know if the pharmacy has these wafers available. Looks like we do. And I think that the shelf life frozen is several years. All right, so good. It's good to know that we have it, and I feel that we'll be using this in the future. Now, this was probably one of the major trials that was done to try to prove the point that a good operation could impact survival. And this data showed that if we can achieve a greater than 90% of resection, we impact patients' overall survival, irrespective of reducing bulk load and, you know, the element of, you know, necrosis. Irrespective of that, a good operation will always be better for patients, and especially if their, you know, medical risk will allow for a good operation. Now, living in Boca, I'm quickly realizing most of our patients are over the age of 85. But you know what? But also, on the same token, most of our patients 85 are very healthy 85s. So age is not a factor. In the olden days, when I was training, actually, age was a factor. Anybody over the age of 75, we would render them, number one, ineligible for trials. You know, actually, 15 years ago, many clinical trials would preclude patients over the age of 70. everybody here is over the age of 70. So now that's changed. It's more about patient's performance status. So so a good operation is safely. So a maximal safe surgical resection is going to be better. For this patient or a similar patient, what options do we have, which are standard therapy options, are going to be the following. You know, the this is a major player. So as the patients heal from surgery with high-grade gliomas, glioblastomas, they will have the process of like the radiation. We have a great program here. And generally, the average theme in the U.S. centers, within 3 to 4 weeks, we can start radiation. In most of other centers outside the U.S., about 3 to 5 weeks. So healing has to happen first. If it's just a biopsy, healing is pretty quicker. We can start radiation within, 9 to 10 days, give an average. But for most larger operative, this case, it takes about 2 to 3 weeks. Now, the chemotherapy options that are currently approved by the FDA, apart from the wafers, are these two chemotherapies, Avastin, and this is an oral chemotherapy, temozolomide. Now, the FDA approval for Avastin is only for recurrent GBMs. I use it for other anaplastic gliomas as well. As you may recall, there were several good trials. Most of them were phase two trials that looked at essentially newly diagnosed glioblastomas and giving them Avastin. In one of my past places where I worked, we were one of the centers that put most patients on those trials, and they were actually very positive trials. But then later, a larger phase three study showed that the improvement was actually marginal. Only 20-30% patients improved, and the FDA was wanting at least 40-45%. So Avastin was not approved for upfront setting for newly diagnosed, albeit behind closed doors on a case-by-case basis. We still give it. Most insurances will give us a hard time, so we can get around those angles. I still feel that the phase two data is strong. And again, don't have time to review that data. Maybe a different time, a different place, we can do that. But I think that using Avastin in the newly diagnosed setting is still critical. Now, another great new frontier, or great ongoing evolving frontier, is essentially clinical trials. Now, we will never be a good program, and we intend to be a good program for a very, very long time to come, to be a good world-class, neuro-oncology program that patients don't have to go to Moffitt Cancer Center, don't have to go to the Mayo Clinic, don't have to go to Duke. For me and for all of us to focus and put a lot of energy behind experimental trials is critical, because anybody can do standard therapies, right? There are many, good sites and good oncologists in the community who can give Avastin and chemotherapy, could even do some of the good operations, or we can do the operations. They can go to the community and get all the other treatment. But yes, we're doing okay. We're following the guidelines. But we have to give above and beyond. I feel that one of the reasons I came here with working with existing team here, is that the opportunity is great. You look at South Florida, it's about 7 million people. University of Miami is probably the only large game in town. And even there, they do a good job, but I feel that we can do it better. So one of our ideas is clinical trials. We need to bring that culture here. And I often say at our meetings, at the research meetings, that it's great to open 20 clinical trials, but what's even more important is to sustain it. That has to be a constant influx of trials, because as all of you know, phase three trials, phase one trials will open and close in 6 months. Phase two trials will open and close in 2 years. Phase three trials will take 5 to 7 years. So at the end of the day, these trials will close, and we need to have an overall impact. And that's why kind of like the academic environment, building and publishing and writing papers, in spite of seeing 50 patients and being exhausted, is actually critically important, because we need to be on the map, and hopefully we have more trials coming in. So this patient, at that moment in time, I didn't have a clinical trial available where I was working at that point in time, so the patient was treated with standard therapy, had 6 weeks of essentially radiotherapy and temozolomide, which is pretty much standard. Now, this standard became standard about 11, 12 years ago, back in 2005. And if you look at neuro-oncology and the top 20 papers published, and it's like the top songs on the hit list, the top 20 papers that were published in neuro-oncology in the past 10 years, this will probably be within the top 5 list. And this basically showed that concomitant chemotherapy, temozolomide, was superior to just adjuvant chemotherapy. So in the olden days, again, before my time, we would give temozolomide within like the post-radiation setting. But this data showed a large study that giving chemotherapy or temozolomide concurrently as well as the adjuvant setting was superior. Now, if you ask Dr. Chowdhury, what was the superiority? What was the survival benefit? Now, in our world, where we look at glioblastomas, where our median survival is, let's say, at best, is 2 years, even a 2 to 3 month benefit is going to be statistically significant. So the benefit was 2.5 to 3 months. So most of you will say, wow, that's really bad. I mean, that's all. So that's kind of like but in our arena, again, that much benefit, it was significant, and hence that was actually FDA approved. So our standard therapy now for any newcomers that hopefully will have clinical trials available, every patient on a trial, and it'll be a trial for every patient. That's kind of like the modality that we try to follow. But for standard therapies, we'll give them involved field therapy, 6 weeks of kind of like the radiation. Now one pitfall that we face very often, almost on like a daily basis in our clinics, is that following radiation, there's an entity of actually pseudoprogression. And there's a lot of, you know, immunotherapies now. We've been dealing with, in our arena, within the neuro-oncology arena, we've been dealing with pseudoprogression for many, many years. But now within like the lung cancer arena and melanoma and other tumor types where a lot of the immunotherapies are now being tried, there's an element of pseudoprogression now in some of those tumors. You see a lung tumor treated with immunotherapy, and then on subsequent MRIs or CAT scans, whatever the, you know, whatever is being done, you'll start seeing increase in size. But if you wait long enough and you're a little bit more patient, the tumor will start actually, you know, essentially decreasing in size. So it's the element of actually necrosis. Now, unfortunately, on a lot of our imaging, a lot of our, you know, routine imaging, PET scanning, I'm sorry, not you know, MRI scanning and, you know, essentially CAT scanning, it's hard for MRI especially to tell between real progression versus, you know, the element of like necrosis. You can see the value in this because we could change therapy. I mean, we can make a wrong decision and change therapy, and a patient is actually responding. So there's an entity of actually pseudoprogression. Now, doing a more of a functional study, like getting a PET scan or a SPECT scan or MR spectroscopy, even though that the sensitivity is about 80-85%, but we do use PET imaging, SPECT imaging, and MR spectroscopy and perfusion to try to tell between necrosis and true tumor progression. And that's also a very critical step. And because of that, a lot of clinical trials, the first 3 months, they encourage us to do MRIs with spectroscopy and perfusion to be really, really sure that what we're seeing is pseudoprogression or is truly pseudoprogression, and the patient doesn't stay on a clinical trial on a drug that was not effective, right? So telling between true tumor progression and pseudoprogression is something that we battle, and it's actually important to tell. Now, pseudoprogression doesn't just happen within the first few weeks. Often the main time frame is between 10 to 14 weeks. So within that 2.5 to about, you know, let's say 2 to 4 months is kind of like the high impact zone, if you will, when most of the pseudoprogression will happen. But there's like, you know, an element of actually delayed pseudoprogression that can go on for several months after. Now, we don't just see pseudoprogression within high grade gliomas and radiation and chemotherapy, but other types of tumor types we see pseudoprogression as well. Now, this patient is back in 2011 when I was treating him. So my standard was to give essentially give Avastin with the oral chemotherapy temozolomide. And young patients, and again, age is not a factor. Their general health is a factor. So I still feel there's a lot of value in giving Avastin. And yes, we always show our cases that, you know, we always show cases that actually had a good outcome. But we have several cases that I feel that really had like essentially a true benefit. This patient had 12 cycles of Avastin, which is about a year of therapy with stable disease, and then the patient was doing fine. Now, as I was doing MRIs, I started to notice a little area of enhancement, and now we're a year out, so the entity of pseudoprogression. It's possible, but it's very slim chance of that happening. So I started to get worried about this small area. Patient was asymptomatic, doing great on chemotherapy, great on the Avastin. So I just started to watch him a little bit more carefully. These MRIs are back from 2012. But as I watched carefully, so I kept him on Avastin for a few more rounds. But as 4, 5, 6 months went by, I started to become nervous because that area was actually increasing. So if it's scar tissue, often we say on MRIs it's probably scarring from surgery, from the radiation. Generally, scar tissue should not grow unless it's more like a necrosis element, which the first few months will be important. So now about a year and a half later, scar tissue should not change. So these increases, again, asymptomatic. Patient was completely asymptomatic, started worrying me. So what can we learn from this case, that or so far what can we learn? So now we have a situation that the tumor is growing, and what are some of the options we have? So these are pretty much the options that, as up to date as possible, that we can look at. Reoperation can be helpful, but as you would agree, in this case the recurrence is very small, so reoperation would not be the way to go. There's actually data with giving a second course of actually radiation. Our common theme used to be, once you get the full course of like the radiation, you're done. No more can be done. But there's good data now at a reduced dose. Generally, you know, 55 to 60 gray is the accepted dose of radiation up front. But then as we do this recourse, about 35 to 45 gray, and there's survival benefits. So there is a possibility that we can actually do the process of like the radiation again. In our case here, we decided not to because the areas were very small. Now, stereotactic radiosurgery, we have a great means or great machine here to do essentially SRS, and often the thought comes out, why can't we just pinpoint do the process of, you know, giving radiation but only pinpoint? This would have been a great case for that if we would have done it. But if you look at the data for high-grade gliomas for SRS, it's not very strong. A lot of the academic centers do it. A lot of the smaller centers don't. But in this case, we elected not to do it. The reason we elected not to do it, we had a clinical trial that, he was a young guy, now he's about 54, that we had a clinical trial that the patient could be on. And if we did SRS, that would preclude the patient from trial. So we elected to do something above and beyond and put the patient on trial. If we wouldn't have stopped here, these were the options back then. Lo and behold, in 4 years, things haven't changed much. Actually, they're the exact same options that I used 4 or 5 years ago that I still use now. And hopefully with clinical trials, we're going to have some new options. So the patient got put on a trial. This is a consortium that I was working with before where I was, and we're hoping to become part of actually Sarah Cannon. We're currently working with them, and hopefully will be a site for actually Sarah Cannon. I've been working with them for almost 10 years now, and if some of you have not heard about them, they do, from the oncology arena, those are the most trials that they do. They have a good, that's one thing they do very well, and I'm hoping that we'll become, again, part of Sarah Cannon and open up door for trials. As I mentioned before, that it's critical for me and for all of us to open 20 trials, but it's more important that it should be a constant influx. So trials closed, as I mentioned, we need to have a constant supply lines. And the way to have supply lines are three things. One, when you have trials, you put patient on trials. Of course, the first important element is do the best for the patient, but we have to show accruals and do good, you know, and manage the patients well. The appropriate patient goes on trial, the inappropriate does not, manage the data well. And then the second thing is we have to publish. We have to write. We have to be academic, that we are a major player here in South Florida, and then go out there and meet people at meetings and hopefully bring more trials. So back then, this study actually got published already, and we were actually part of that paper. It was presented as a poster at ASCO twice in a year. So this was a novel drug. It's used in other cancer types. BKM-120, which inhibits a pathway that is very overexpressed in many aggressive cancers, and GBM included. So we noticed that Avastin, which is an anti-angiogenic agent, and I mentioned earlier that GBMs in many tumors are very aggressive, so anti-angiogenic agents that shut down blood vessel growth has been an interest. And Avastin is not the only anti-angiogenic agent, but one of the 7 or 8 that we've been trying to use. It's the only approved drug, though. So patient received this oral drug with Avastin, and lo and behold, the first MRI after treatment, if you remember the previous scans, there was actually treatment response. Now, just to give you a little idea, that patient stayed on trial for 2.5 years. He was the longest survivor on that trial. And then after 2.5 years, due to side effects to drugs, been on Avastin for now about 3.5, 4 years. As some of you have used Avastin, after a while it gets hard to take. So the patient said, "Charlie, I want to come off it. I just want to take my chances." So it was a kind of a nervous moment to stop a patient with an aggressive brain tumor off a trial or a drug that's been working or a treatment that's been working. So eventually we elected to take the patient off study, and then he did very well for so many years, and now he comes down to Boca and follows me every 4 months with an MRI. So that patient's story, not over, but it's over for now, and it's been a good outcome. So we feel that genomics is important, that individualizing therapy is important. Now, I never did any of those fancy genomic tests, because those labs were not available so much back then as they are now. But I bet you if I was to do it now, it's probably that an enzyme pathway is overexpressed, or maybe more overexpressed in him than others. And probably by chance we got lucky that drug was like the best fit for that patient. And now 5 years later, which for a grade 4 glioblastoma is a really good outcome. Now, if such patients further recur, these are the options we have. Again, surgery will always be an option. You know, often I get the question, how many operations can we do? If patient's health is good, the maximum I've seen is about 7 operations. That was a patient in his actually 20s. But generally speaking, up to 3 operations would be the way to go. Most patients after a third recurrence will be in a state that may not want to have an operation. So surgery will always be an option. Re-radiation, I spoke about that earlier, that there's good data at a low dose of radiation, 45 gray average. And we are doing it here. Actually, Dr. Williams and I and Casper, Dr. Benda shared a case that we actually radiated again at time of recurrence. Clinical trials often will be an option. This is a very novel device that I wanted to at least put that in your mind, another take-home message, something known as actually NovoTTF. Now, NovoTTF, you got to, bear with me before you start telling me that can't work. That is actually essentially a tumor treatment fields that create this almost like a field around the tumor, and the whole concept is that it prevents tumor growth. And I have a couple of slides that might explain that better. Genomics, I spoke about that. Caris and Foundation Medicine are the two labs we use. They're actually private labs. The tests are very expensive, range anywhere from $7,000 to $22,000, depending on how many genes you test. I would imagine as technology, like anything else, things will get cheaper over time, but Caris and Foundation Medicine are two labs that we use. Now, a lot of the major academics, like Duke, for instance, they do their own tests. The volume is enough, the funding is enough. They almost never send to Caris. They do everything internally. And hopefully, as our program grows in 5 to 10 years, we'll be at a point that we'll be able to test some of these. But for now, anybody who comes with a glial tumor, we always send to one of the labs. I mean, I used to favor Caris, but I try to spread it out. I don't think there's any data. You talk to any company, they say we're going to be better than the other company, and there's always some plus and minuses, but I think they're all pretty much equal. Depends on what you're comfortable with, who you like, whose report you like, but I try to spread it out to almost everybody. Avastin with CCNU, there was a trial that showed, because often people have said over the years that Avastin works pretty good by itself, we don't need to add chemotherapies to it. But there's a lot of believers like myself who feel that more is better in some occasions. If patients can tolerate, more is better. So there was this published a couple of years ago that showed that Avastin plus CCNU was superior, significantly superior, survival benefit up to 8 to 10 months greater with using Avastin alone. So often my second, third line after clinical trials is to give CCNU and Avastin. Carboplatin and Avastin, there's another trial that was just about to be published, and I'm hoping it's going to be a positive trial. Then we basically figure out any combination of Avastin you can imagine, right? Avastin etoposide, Avastin BCNU. And you can tell by this time we're in a tough spot here, right? We're kind of like, running in circles. We're trying to do the best we can for patients. But the point is that we're there for the journey, and we try not to give in. Try not to give up. As long as a patient wants to fight, we try to keep fighting. So I'm going to skip through some slides. We have 10 minutes left, and I wanted to maybe finish off in 5 and then leave a few moments for questions. This is the therapy I was talking about, NOVA-TTF, which is a tumor treatment fields. So their philosophy is, if you want to be a believer, there are non-believers, and half of this room can decide to not believe, but there's definitely one half they'll say, hey, maybe this works. But it has been proven in phase 3 trials, believe it or not. It's FDA approved, and essentially it prevents cell division more so in high-grade glioma cells than essentially normal cells. Now, the initial trials that were done were that it is non-inferior to standard therapy. So it was not a superiority trial. It's more like a non-inferiority trial that showed that that it was as good as recurrent salvage chemotherapy setting, but less side effects. The patients essentially, I'll skip through, applied the device to their scalp. So there are some challenges, as you can see right off the bat, right? Patients have to shave their heads. They have to wear the device 18 hours out of the day, and it's every day. And if it works, you do MRIs, you take the device off, patients have to stay on it. What's good about it is that there's almost no, you know, there are no side effects. So it's not like giving chemotherapy that they can have liver toxicity and they can get tired and fatigued. The only side effect is by putting the scalp electrodes that they can get a little bit of like a rash. But even that's about 20-30% of patients. So majority of patients tolerate very well. The only challenge being wearing the device all the time, carrying like almost like a battery pack when they're traveling at home. They don't have to do that. So it does take a little bit of like an upkeep to do. But, you know, I often get the question, Chowdhury, how many patients have you offered it to? And they said, no way that we're ever going to do this. You know, it's kind of interesting. When I first went into this, I thought that's going to happen very frequently. It's only one patient that I've offered in the past 5 years that has refused to do it. So when you get come to a point of, you know, high-grade gliomas where median survival, they know that their lifespan is going to be limited. They want to do everything they can. So we offer this therapy. We have several patients on it, and we're going to continue doing it. So I know we talked a little bit about that, about sending off for tumor genomics. And I feel that spending 30 seconds of the slide is very critical, because today when we leave this room moving forward to the future, you know, genomics is going to be the future in trying to target therapies and finding drugs or finding, you know, essentially actionable mutations. Now, this is from Caris, which is just one of the labs we use out of many, until we get our internal labs working, that will actually do genomic markers. And then what's more important, like I was highlighting, that it's kind of fancy to tell patients, hey, we tested, you know, 1,000 genes on you. This is really good stuff. But what's more important is to tell them that there are drugs that we can match. Now, many of these drugs are not approved for high-grade gliomas, for fragile glioblastomas. But we've been very successful. It takes a lot of work. It takes some effort. And a lot of the academic cancer centers, they have separate programs that their sole job is to get these non-FDA-approved drugs approved. So that's all they do, because a lot of the oncologists, like all of you, like myself, you know, we're in our clinics, we're busy. We don't have time to fill out a 10-page form and take, you know, 5 different phone calls, then hear no after a week of struggle, they say no at the end. So what's important is how do you put forth all the paperwork. So in good academic centers, they have separate programs that are doing this, and they quote a success rate of 85%. That 85% of times they can get a totally expensive non-approved drug for a patient with a tumor that drug is not approved for. And many of these, you know, pharma companies, I know we say a lot of things about them, but pharma companies are doing some things right, that they often will, patient assistance programs will give these drugs for free. So if we work hard enough and we try hard enough, we can get these drugs approved, and we hope to do that here as well. So just the same, we've kind of gone through some of these things and some of the lessons learned from this one case. I want to spend the last 2 minutes, while I'm going over, I want to finish at 8:25, one more minute, and then we'll take some questions. I want to bring you guys home now, and that's what's happening in the world. I want to bring you back down to our facility at Boca, in our cancer center, our neuroscience institute, that what are we doing above and beyond, and what our vision is. We want to do standard therapies. We want to take patients from point A to point B and be there for the whole journey and give them a great experience, and also with compassion. And all that is good and very important. But we also want to give them above and beyond therapy so they have no need to go anywhere else. You know, they have no need to go to Moffitt, no need to go to Mayo Clinic. Albeit those are fantastic places. We've trained in those places. But we hope to keep our patients here. And this is how we're going to keep our patients here. You know, anybody who gets any cancer these days are on Google right away. And they know that the best clinical trials are far away. You have to go to the West Coast. Patients are ready to second mortgage their homes and just travel where they need to go, especially when they're told that your median survival is 2 years. So we need to stop that. We need to stop those patients leaving and do trials here, accrue patients, publish papers, and then we'll become a major player. So these are the trials that we, in real time, is happening here, and hopefully this is going to continue. For essentially newly diagnosed glioblastoma, this alliance, this is actually a very... Essentially, a novel drug, veliparib, which is a radiosensitizer, and also works with, you know, temozolomide has a joint effect. And it's not open, but I'm hoping within 2 weeks we'll have the trial open. We had a patient that recently operated with a newly diagnosed GBM, glioblastoma with large resection. Some of you may remember the case. And within 3 weeks from the start radiation, I'm hoping this trial becomes open and that patient is going to be a candidate. This is if you look at kind of the buzz phrases these days and what is the hallmark of a good oncology program, you know, having a vaccine trial, as most of you know, is very critical. If we're going to be not a good program, but a great program that everybody pays attention to, we must have a vaccine. Sorry to say it, we first have to think about patients first, but having a vaccine trial is very critical. So we are actually going to be one of the only two sites for this vaccine trial. It's a phase 3 trial. We're in the process of like the site initiation visits, and everything is going to come together, and hopefully this will be our first, you know, vaccine trial, which these are the kind of trials that will actually pull patients from all over the state of Florida. So I'm hoping that these kinds of things will happen. NRG is a big consortium. Again, as I highlighted a few times, that we need an influx of trials, and consortia trials are going to give us the influx. Alliance, big consortia, Sarah Cannon, and then Duke and other major academic centers. Now, for recurrent glioblastomas, we have Nativus, which is a device like de novo TTF, but patients don't have to shave their heads, and it's not an electrode placement. It's more like a halo. This was actually our first patient accrual, and since I've been here, we have one patient that just went on this trial, and it's pretty easy to do, and we're the only site in the state of Florida for this trial. Other trials coming off, we actually have a collaborative trial with a clinic, which is Optune, which is Nova TTF with Avastin. Optune has been looked. Optune is a trade name for that device. Optune's been looked at single agent, but never with Avastin. It's the first trial looking at that, and we're going to be a part of that trial. This is a virus vector trial. Another, amazing trials that will attract patients to us is, apart from vaccine trials, is going to be virus vector trials. You all know about the Duke study, which injected virus directly in a tumor. This trial is not the Duke trial. Maybe we'll get that too, but this is more of a different virus vector that changes an inactive drug, a pro-drug, into an active drug, and then locally changes a drug-active drug within the tumor and essentially will cause the tumor to die. So that's going to be a virus vector trial. The Florida trial for anaplastic gliomas, and other collaborative trials. We have a few tissue trials. As when we trained, we were told you have to have a trial for every patient. Every patient should be in a trial. So we have a couple of tissue trials coming up, and then brain mets. I'm going to stop there. It's 8:29. Sorry, I was hoping to finish 4 minutes ago. But I appreciate the patience, and it's a big topic to cover. But, there's a lot of exciting things that are coming, not only in the high-grade glioma world and a national level, but at our site here, and hopefully in 6 months I can bring essentially good news, even more good news. Thank you.
Two questions. Which chemo agent are they using?
It's going to be BCNU. So it's essentially BCNU, which is a 1,000-year-old drug. And so they use BCNU because a lot of the initial data for using Gliadel was being done back in the 1980s and early 1990s, when before temozolomide and Avastin and all the trials, BCNU was a standard drug. So plus it was cheap, so they that's the drug in it.
Would you comment about the new trial with the polio virus? What is the status of that?
Good point. So I've known Dr. Friedman for a lot of years. Now, one thing good about neuro-oncology is the community is very small. We all get to know each other. And when I was in my past life, before I moved here, Duke had all – so the trial was the poliovirus trial, which a semi-live virus injected directly in the tumor. The inclusion criteria are very strict. It has to be a gross total resection. So you can argue and say that you're kind of sub-selecting the best patients that are going to do good anyways, and then you're injecting. So the virus is injected directly, and what it does, it works in two ways. One, it causes tumor kill by the virus invasion of tumor cells. Two, it instigates an immune response. You know, one of the challenges we have, and again, there's maybe a different time, different day, we can talk about why immunotherapies are critical in our line of work, that the brain is a safe haven. There's no immune system in the brain. So the tumors survive and they find the escape. And so the poliovirus instigates an immune response against the poliovirus, and then it integrates its genetic material into the tumor's genetic material. So the immune system starts recognizing glioblastoma cells as the poliovirus, as kind of like what they need to kill. And so that's the whole philosophy behind a lot of these viral vector trials. Now, Henry has, you know, I don't want to count our chickens before they hatch, but Henry's been looking for a Florida site. And, you know, if you look at the state of Florida, we're 21 million people. The incidence of cancer is we're one of the top, if not the top. And the southeast seaboard is a cluster of high-grade gliomas. So Henry's always been very enthusiastic about having a Duke site here that they can do trials. So I'm hoping that we would be selected. And then as the phase one trial, which is now about, is being prepared to roll into the phase two portion, which is going to be multi-site and only a few sites. And you know how Duke works. They kind of run the show, right? I mean, they can pick and choose who they want. So I'm hoping that we would be one of their sites. I think both, yeah. So I'll answer the second question first. I feel surgeons, there are two kinds of surgeons, a non-aggressive brain tumor surgeon and an aggressive brain tumor surgeon. And the non-aggressive brain tumor surgeons are definitively leaving a lot behind. I mean, they're leaving stuff on MRI, but they're being less aggressive. Now, it also depends on the location of the tumor. You have an anterior right frontal tumor, which is in a right-handed person. I shouldn't say that there's no brain that can easily be taken out, but that's an area that you could be more aggressive. And good academic, aggressive neurosurgeons will take margins. I mean, I don't think that the pathologist reads it that way. Maybe some do, but they will be more aggressive to address some of the, you know, a lot of the microscopic disease. And most of the animal models, I'm happy you brought that up, forgot to mention, most of the animal models have shown that there's about two to five millimeters is where in most animal, you know, high-grade glioma models that tumor invasion happens. Majority of it is about almost a half a centimeter at best. So by removing half a centimeter, you are addressing that big question of a lot of the microscopic disease. So I feel it doesn't happen enough. So I do agree with you that should happen more. What was your first question?
Pre-surgical radiation.
So it's been looked at many, 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 many moons ago, and the only problem with post-craniotomies after radiation, unless it's like SBRT or SRS, where the skin doesn't get impacted, but if you look at involved field radiation, 3D conformal, the radiation exposure on the skin and the bone becomes difficult to healing postoperatively. So by doing radiation preoperatively, and I see your thought, it's a good thought to reduce, you know, debulk the tumor, shrink it. With other tumor oncology arena, we do that and then remove the tumor. I do know that there were a couple of trials that were done, but there were not positive trials. The big challenge was that the healing, or the fear was that post-op healing will not be as good because the skin's been radiated. And often with like the recurrent gliomas, we see that after they've been radiated, and God forbid twice, that often we'll elect not to even operate because the healing fear is that skin may not heal. But I believe I did hear about one trial that's being done looking at high-grade gliomas and low-dose radiation with SRS. So there are multiple beams that are converging on one point instead of three large beams with the 3D conformal, in which the exposure per, you know, gram of tissue and bone is much higher. If you do SRS, you're actually reaching it from 101 different portals. So the individual radiation dose to a piece of skin is very small. And so after SRS, removing the tumor, And so there are some studies being done. All right, guys, thank you.